Hello, and welcome to the South African History Archives' Freedom of Information Program podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to have conversations with various individuals around the right to access of information in South Africa. Hi, and welcome back to SAHA's Freedom of Information podcast. I'm so glad that you could join us. Today, we have an absolutely amazing special guest with us today, Piers Pigou. He is one of our board members, and he is a renowned expert in transitional justice, as well as issues around access to information. So we are very excited to have an expert of his caliber joining us today. And the topic for today is the issues around the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa. This year, 2018, marks 20 years of the final report of the TRC being completed. And so it's a special time for South Africa to pause and reflect on the good, the bad, and the ugly of the TRC, and some of the criticisms that have risen around the TRC in this generation. And here at SAHA, we have previously done other work to gain access to TRC records, and this is known as the Section 29 litigation that happened, and we were able to gain access to some of the TRC records that were not previously released. So if you're interested in that, please go onto our website and take a look at that. But for today, thank you so much, Piers, for joining us.
Well, thank you, Nobu, and it's a pleasure to come and talk about this subject that has fallen off so many people's radar screens.
It really has. And so I think I'm just going to start with not the easiest of questions, but the difficult one, because you were involved in the TRC. Was the TRC a failure?
Well, you know, it depends from what vantage point you're looking. The Truth Commission, in many ways, has become a dustbin for people's problems, and the people like to point it and say there's no reconciliation, there's no truth in the country, there are prosecutions, the reparations issues, and they point the finger at the Truth Commission. I think that there is much to criticize the Truth Commission about, but there is also a lot that I think is not properly understood about what the Commission could have really achieved in terms of the mandate it had and the resources it had and the time in which it was operating. In my opinion, it was a good first step. It provided a foundation stone from which a lot more work was needed to happen. And unfortunately, much of that work fell by the wayside for one reason or another.
I think that's a great analysis. And I think from what we hear in conversations is that a lot of people maybe don't quite understand what the mandate of the TRC was and what was the actual purpose of setting up a TRC at the time that it was set, because many people view it as, you know, it was like a feel-good activity for South Africa to just brush away apartheid and move on. But we know that's not exactly what happened. And maybe you could tell our listeners, what was the original intended mandate of the TRC at the time of its constitution?
Well, a number of people think that the Truth Commission was an output from the negotiated settlement. In fact, it wasn't. You know, this issue of how to deal with the past was hovering throughout the negotiated process between 1990 and 1994. And actually, it was only really with the penning of the interim constitution, which was signed in December 1993, in which in the preamble of that constitution, it says that we will have some kind of way of dealing with the past. It was only after the elections in 1994 and the establishment of the first democratic parliament that that parliament then started a process of discussing, in an interaction with civil society as well, what kind of mechanism can we use to engage with the past? And because this was a negotiated settlement, this was not going to be any kind of retributive process. And the issues of truth commissions were still relatively fresh. There'd been some experiences in Latin America, but really not very many processes had been undertaken at that stage of looking into the past.
So just to get this clear, the TRC was not a top-down decision. It didn't just come from the politicians behind closed doors, because you mentioned that there was, you know, consultation in civil society. And I think this is an element of the TRC that's often forgotten, that they were people who were consulted in the process.
Oh, absolutely. They, you know, one can argue that it wasn't consultative enough and that more people should have been brought into that conversation. But essentially, it was some civil society activists and the churches here that drove conversations across the country in a number of fora about how to deal with the past. Experts who've been participants in the Truth Commissions in Chile and in Argentina were brought and were part of conferences and discussions that took place. Politically, interestingly, within the ANC, as the ruling party, or the majority party, because remember, it was a government of national unity in 1994-1995, but members of the ANC and significant parts of other parties, and the other two major parties there was the National Party and the Inkatha Freedom Party, were pretty hostile to a Truth Commission process and really weren't keen on engaging this. But it was driven by key members of the executive, Dula Omar, the Minister of Justice, people like Kada Asmal, the Minister of Education, and of course Mandela, who gave it his imprimatur. And I think it was his protection of this process throughout that kept it alive politically.
Thank you for that. And during the TRC, they were people who were recognized, in quotes, as having been the victims. And this was a number of, I think, about 18,000 people. How was this number determined, and why is it so low?
Right. Well, 21,000 people, approximately 22,000 people came to the Truth Commission to make statements. That was only ever going to be a subset of the total number of victims in the country. If you did a breakdown of the time frame of the incidents that they reported on, the vast majority of people reflected on violence that occurred during the early 1990s. In fact, the early 1990s was the most violent period in the mandated period for the Truth Commission from 1960 to 1994. 14,000 people died in that four-year period, and many thousands more were injured. That's more than the combined total of the previous 30 years in terms of deaths and injuries. So in terms of violations, that's where the majority of cases were. But even then, we saw that only a percentage of the total figure came to the commission. The commission needed to make a decision on how it would declare people to be victims. So it put in place a protocol, a process by which the commission made a decision, a determination on all of those cases. And within that process, several thousand were thrown out, so to speak, not meeting the victim criteria that they had determined. And it was the determination of victim status that then tied into whether you received individual reparations. Now, some of us were arguing, because we knew there were many gaps in the record, so to speak, temporally in terms of the time period. You know, you only had a handful of people coming from the 60s and from the 70s, for example. But also spatially, across the country, significant communities were not properly engaged. You know, in terms of the public hearing processes, they did go out, they were proactive in doing that, but they didn't reach many, many communities, and many people didn't have that opportunity to come forward. So some of us argued post-commission that there needed to be what we called an open list. This was through the lens of reparation. We wanted an open list for people to be able to come and explain their stories, because they should also have an opportunity to access reparations. And the government shut that down. The government was not interested in an open list. And so we were unable to continue any kind of truth recovery process post-truth commission, which was, I think, a major mistake, because dealing with the past post-Truth Commission has been almost exclusively through the lens of prosecution. But we can talk about prosecution in more detail later.
We'll get to that. And I think if we could just continue to touch on reparations. Because
yes.
I think a lot of us don't understand, you know, there's the issue that the amount was really low, that it was an insignificant amount. There was the argument that expecting the new South African black government to carry this burden of the old apartheid government was unjust, and that it was just perpetuating some of the advantages that the apartheid system created in terms of the economic divide.
Well, look, you know, I mean, I think that, again, the compromises of a negotiated settlement meant that inevitably the new government was going to carry on some of the burdens and financial burdens of the old government. I mean, we see that most extensively in the new government accepting the debt burden of the old government and actually having to spend a significant amount of its income every year for a number of years to service and pay off that debt. The amount of money that was recommended by the Truth Commission for reparations was actually relatively reasonable. For each person, it was a figure of about 120,000 rand. That was the figure that was recommended that would be split over a period of 6 years. The government, in its own wisdom, as the government of Thabo Mbeki, decided to actually just ignore that completely and go for this 30,000 one-off payment, which the commission was certainly not recommending. It was recommending something that would provide some kind of stipend over the years. They wanted also for the government to be a little bit more thoughtful about how it could support with medical, educational support, those kinds of things. And it would have been possible with the right resources and the right team to fashion an instrument that could have been much more nuanced and responsive to needs, as opposed to this kind of once-off, catch-all 30,000 giveaway. If we look at how much money is spent on all sorts of ridiculous things by our government at the moment, from VIP protection to fancy cars, the amount of money that's been spent on reparations is actually minimal. Mm. In terms of those who may have had certain responsibilities in the past or were beneficiaries, there was a recommendation by the Commission for a wealth tax, a once-off payment for the super wealthy to contribute to the reparations fund. This was completely ignored by the Mbeki administration.
You're a political analyst as well. Please, can you help us understand what do you think was the thinking behind these decisions?
Well, you know, my sense is, and I'd like to explore it more in terms of what were the push and the pull factors, but it's important to remember that key elements of the ANC and the activist community in general were quite hostile to the Truth Commission. Their hostility and their concerns were that this was an exercise, as Thabo Mbeki said, that criminalized the ANC. This is what, you know, when the commission handed its interim report in November 1998 over to Madiba, you had the Inkatha Freedom Party, the National Party, and the ANC all going to court to try and stop the TRC from producing this report.
And just a pause on that. Do you think that that decision of the TRC was correct to look at it from a both sides lens? Because, you know, there was a war. The ANC would argue, we were fighting for our freedom and our liberation. Why are we being punished for that?
Well, the you know, and this is, I think, a very important point, because and there was a criticism, and it was a reason why many activists didn't go to the commission, because they said, well, you know, you can't equate what we did to the other side. And I think if you read, and this is my response often to this question, is if people have not read the Truth Commission report, they will not see that the Truth Commission made a distinction between what it called a primary cancer and a secondary cancer. However, it had to look at violations through a particular lens of, was that murder, was that torture, and so forth. And if it found someone was responsible for torture or murder or so forth, on whichever side of the conflict, it had to make that finding. However, it explained those things in a broader context. So, as I said, it described the apartheid security forces and the violations perpetrated under the aegis of the National Party government as the primary cancer, the primary. But within that context, the ANC and other liberation movements violated international law, because that was the framework that they were using, was international law. So it is a fallacy to say that this criminalized the ANC, because there was a distinction made between just war and just means. And so, for instance, the targeting of civilians by the ANC, which when they were using in the landmine campaign in the 1980s, the ANC received a lot of flack for that and, in fact, stopped that program. The targeting, it did accept from the mid-1980s following the Kabwe conference in 1985 that there would be at times civilian casualties, but they would be collateral damage. As opposed to going in and planting a car bomb in the middle of a supermarket area or whatever it might be. So we can see from the way that the ANC behaved in its in persecuting its, prosecuting its liberation war, that it was relatively constrained in what it did. It could have killed a lot more people if it won. In the same way, you could argue that aspects of the apartheid forces could have been a lot more brutal. They were brutal, but they could have killed a lot more people if they wanted to. I think the commission's report, and very few people have read the commission's report. Let's make that very clear. Okay, you've got a huge tome of five volumes, which is almost inaccessible, certainly costly, but a popular report was never disseminated.
This is like...
It was produced, believe it or not, Nobu. It was produced. They made one.
I personally went through the process of trying to read all of those volumes, and I haven't gone through it.
Sure.
Because
Very few of the experts out there have done that. But just a quick aside on the popular report, because a popular report was produced, but it was never published in South Africa. It was never finalized and published. And what we heard was, which was rather shocking, and this will shock the listeners as well, is that it was sold, the rights were sold to a German publishing house, translated into German, and in fact for a while you could get the popular report of the South Africa's Truth Commission in German, in Germany, but not here. So most South Africans have never read the findings or the recommendations of the TRC. And I think that's a really important thing, and that's also part, I think, of the problem of an administration that truncated any further post-TRC activity. This is why we have an archive of the Truth Commission that lies in unprocessed and largely inaccessible. And, you know, if it wasn't for Saha, really, pushing access to information requests to get those documents out there, they'd still be lying in there, inaccessible.
And I think this issue of misunderstanding of the TRC comes in this generation, particularly with the story of Umama Winnie Mandela. And that's a very controversial situation, but the new documentary, it sheds, it's not so new, but the documentary on the life of Winnie that made all the airplay and all the headlines after her untimely passing, it makes the TRC process the villains. And there is a generation out there that is growing up with complete disregard for the TRC and with the firm belief that it was an illegitimate process, you know. And how do you counter those narratives?
I have a particular interest in this case because I was the investigator in the Winnie Mandela case. So at the Truth Commission. And so when I saw that documentary, in which I am acknowledged as one of the people assisting that filmmaker in the back of that film, and I was pretty appalled by the manner in which that film was put together, because it's a selective engagement with the facts. I think it's important, a generic comment is that the Truth Commission was never meant to be the final word on matters. It was to promote a conversation. There is a context in which the Winnie Mandela hearings took place in 1997. There was no great planning behind it. I mean, as I said, I was instrumentally involved in this from start to finish. So was involved in the in-camera hearings with Winnie in September 1997. And of course, it was during those hearings that she was subpoenaed to the commission, and she was very upset about having been subpoenaed. Why didn't you just invite me, she said. And, you know, that's a decision that the commissioners made. But when we ran those private hearings, those in-camera hearings, she demanded, she wanted a public hearing. So what happened subsequently in November, at the end of November 1997, where I think we had about 63 witnesses that we put on the stand, including people who are now Supreme Court judges, cabinet ministers, and so forth, and testified. They testified about the events around the Mandela United Football Club, which fed into the findings against Mrs. Mandela in relation to a series of incidents of murder and torture and so forth. However, there was a political context in which that took place. And people, and I think that people are right to interrogate that political context. I think they are right to say, well, was this also part of an attempt to shut Winnie down? She was at the time trying to become the Deputy Secretary General of the ANC in the Mafeking Conference in December 1997. Did it relate to a broader thrust to contain radical elements within the ANC that we saw accompanied the negotiation process, and there's conspiracy theories about with the death of Hani and these kinds of people, that she was part of a grouping inside the ANC that was promoting a line on what should be in the negotiations, what should be compromised or not compromised, and that had to be silenced. I think these things need to be interrogated, and I think it's important. But the Truth Commission, having worked inside it, and I listened to the conspiracy theorists out there, I really wasn't that organized to be that conspiratorial. We were running by the seat of our pants on these things. And, we were also concerned about this whole, the role of the security police around Winnie. And that's why in January 1998, we held another four-day set of hearings, which many people forget about, where we interrogated the role of the security police, and we had a number of security policemen in front of there. And actually, if people read the chapter on the Mandela United Football Club in the TRC report, they'll see a lot of issues raised about and unanswered questions about the role of the military in terms of stoking up the violence, the internal dynamics within the Mandela United Football Club and its fights with the community in Soweto. So lots of unanswered questions. There's a new book that's just come out this month called Truth and Alibis about Winnie Mandela, which asks a lot of and engages with a lot of the unanswered questions that came out of the commission process in relation to some of those murders. So I think that there's lots of unanswered questions, but there is a tendency, and we understand that because of the iconic status of Mrs. Mandela, that people want to put a fence around her and protect her from any kind of real scrutiny. The reality is she is a remarkable lens in which to look at South Africa's journey, political journey, its journey of repression and its journey of violation, because in my opinion she is the classic victim perpetrator in which she was terribly victimized for many, many years. Those issues were not dealt with by the Truth Commission. Mrs. Mandela did not come to the Truth Commission to say
to share her story,
as so many activists didn't, and she was rather distasteful. She also took a decision, it was clear to me, that she was going to fight this. There was no way she was going to subject herself to a process where she would appear to be weak. So she took a very hard line, as we saw in those hearings, dismissed everyone as a liar and a lunatic, and that she was only telling the truth. And I'm afraid the available information that was sitting there weighed very heavily against her in terms of her culpabilities. But at the same time, this was not a court of law. And I think that there is a tendency in this country to think that the commission's findings have some kind of legal gravitas to them, which they do not. But the other problem, of course, is that making findings against Mrs. Mandela around a narrow set of issues, and bear in mind the primary focus of the commission's look at the Mandela United Football Club was in a four-month period between November 1998 and February 1989, when a whole series of incidents took place, that you cannot judge one person on a set of incidents that took place in such a narrow time frame. So I think that there's a tendency to take things out of context. It feeds particular agendas, and because we have a whole group of people in this country who like to say that Mrs. Mandela is the mugger of the nation, as opposed to the majority of people who like to see her as the mother of the nation. So these kind of crude binary narratives have remained in place. And it was very interesting watching those emerge again following her death earlier this year. I was approached by a number of people to do interviews and discussions, and I refused to do that because it didn't seem to me appropriate to get involved in that discussion at that stage because it would be manipulated. I can give a lot of detail about nasty stuff, and I can raise a lot of questions, but I know that's not the full picture. Yes. I know that's only part of the picture. And I think it's important that people understand that the truth, and it goes back to my earlier comment, that the Truth Commission really started conversations, and it should have been part of ongoing conversations. Not that we become trapped by the past, but that we try and understand.
Piers, thank you so much for that. Winnie was revered by so many people. And I think as humans, sometimes we do struggle to understand complex human beings, and everyone is either a hero or a villain, and we just can't accept them as humans who were living life in a difficult situation and may have made some bad decisions and did a lot of good for the nation. And for that, we honor her and we thank her, and we are a generation that must sort of move on from that. But it can be manipulated to by the different political interest to either make her this really bad person, but then those who would sanctify her will then look at the TRC as a whole and say the entire process was a farce and disregard the work that came out of there. And so, you know, the TRC was meant to be a non-political commission. And I think there is sometimes a different confusion in understanding the commission itself and the work of the government post the commission and the political will that was required to fulfill the recommendations of a non-political commission. And this comes up particularly in the context of the prosecutions that have never taken place. The TRC was meant to say, the TRC did specifically state that if you came and you applied for amnesty, you would, and you shared your story and you were open, then you would receive amnesty. And those who were implicated and didn't apply for amnesty would be prosecuted after the commission. This is like a summary of basically what was supposed to happen. But we know that there were people who were not granted amnesty by the commission and were never prosecuted. And there were people who didn't even bother to go to the commission. And they are known, they are identifiable as having been people who violated so many people's rights, and nothing happened post the commission. Can you speak to that?
Well, it's a complex and it's a contested subject area. But essentially, you're correct. The inference of being refused amnesty or not coming forward was that you could face prosecution if indeed there was evidence to pursue that. And at the end of the Truth Commission process, we know that over 7,000 people applied for amnesty. The vast majority of those were rejected, most of those in chambers. They were decisions made on the basis of the application, not in public hearings. And of the 1,500 or so that went through amnesty hearings, you can break those down into different groups. Actually, the vast majority of those came from the liberation movements, not from the security forces. There were probably less than 350 people that came from the security forces who applied for and gave amnesty. But they did give us a remarkable insight into a number of cases that we would never have had detail on before in terms of killings and deaths from well-known activists like Stanza Bopapi through to others who are less known. But essentially, because of the work that had been done in the run-up in 93 and 94 that led to the arrest of Eugene de Kock as the head of FLUCPLUS, the apartheid counterinsurgency death squads, Eugene, after he was found guilty in 1996, just sang like a canary and opened the door to all sorts of other cases. And this led to cascading number of people from the police death squads coming forward and applying for amnesty. And this is why we got a lot of information about what the police did, the military less so. Yeah. But again, there are temporal and spatial gaps throughout in terms of the amnesty record. At the end of the commission forwarded a list of about 900 cases to the prosecuting authorities. Those were then kind of whittled down into a listing of 200 to 300 cases where there could be some prospect of further investigation, not necessarily prosecution, but at least further investigation. And it was there that things got stuck, because that got parked under a unit inside the National Prosecuting Authority called the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit. And they essentially were unable to pursue these matters. Why? Because they never had any resources allocated for investigations. They were meant to have police officers allocated them. They were never allocated. Now, watching this for a number of years now, you could say, well, why the hell did they never do anything about this? Frankly, in my opinion, there was an unwritten agreement not to prosecute. Mm. And I think this is one of many unwritten agreements relating to our past and the negotiated settlement and all these kinds of things, which we have little insight into. And I think this is why a younger generation is rightly questioning aspects of these things. And I think that it's important that they interrogate that. But it's also important that there is an explanation about the conditions, about the constraints of being able to pursue these kinds of issues. I think there is a sense in terms of prosecutions that if they'd gone after people that hadn't applied for amnesty, if they hadn't gone after both sides, that would have been a problem. And therefore, it was easier politically to let sleeping dogs lie, so to speak. Okay. And I think that's what we were... But because of the activism of certain individuals, like the Timol family and so forth, some of these cases have started to reemerge again.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's for us, for many people, all you hear is that there was just lack of political will. And because we live in such a corrupt country, from a government level and private level, you just aren't, you generally think the motives of government are always dodgy. So if like people aren't prosecuted, you're like, oh, well, there's something dodgy behind that. But it is important to get perhaps a deeper analysis around why some of those prosecutions didn't happen.
I think there's a range of competing forces that were pushing this. I mean, for me, one of the problems always was that the only efforts post-Truth Commission to try and uncover the truth were being pursued through the lens of prosecution. Now, with one set of exceptions, which, of course, is the exhumation unit that the NPA have been running and doing some remarkable work in locating people and connecting them back to families and so forth. But there is a connection there with prosecution as well, and actually, interestingly, one with Winnie Mandela, where one of the big cases involving Mrs. Mandela involved two youngsters who disappeared, and actually the disappearance unit found those youngsters. And when their bodies were dug up, there was a real prospect, but no one was pushing for it, for a case against Mrs. Mandela of kidnapping, because there were witnesses for that she was one of the last people seen with those kids. So you know, it became difficult, and you could see the National Prosecuting Authority sort of taking its foot off the gas on that case visibly, because there was no public call for prosecution or anything against Mrs. Mandela, but there's an incident where they could have pursued. But on the other side, many cases against security policemen and even members of the military that could have been pursued if there had been the political will to do so. So in many ways, the Truth Commission might be construed as a containment strategy on how to deal with the past, that it wanted to shine the light, but it did not want to push certain agendas, push certain lines too hard, because it would become possibly politically destabilizing. So I think that fed certain agendas. But certainly, if you look at the findings of the commission pointed its finger at all the main perpetrators. And there were four key perpetrators in terms of institutions: the National Party, the ANC, the IFP, and the Pan-Africanist Congress. And they all were found responsible in some respects for having violated gross violations of human rights in terms of international legal standards. But as I said, the report puts an explanation to those violations. It puts a context to those violations. And it is certainly not an exercise in equating violations between the different sides.
But just on this particular point, you say, do you think that, you say that the TRC was meant to contain at the time. Do you think it achieved that? And looking at this current generation and some of that rage that is there, and that those feelings of betrayal that a lot of young people have towards the stalwarts of the ANC, and a lot of rage against the people that traditionally benefited from apartheid.
I think that in some respects the disjuncture between the youth of today and that period, and the processes that were agreed to and undertaken, like the Truth Commission, that we're reaping the negative side of, or we're reaping the consequences of not having invested in post-TRC processes that came out of the recommendations around education, around awareness raising, around continued work on the Truth Commission type, you know, to do further truth recovery in communities, to work with communities on those issues, to start developing reconciliation agendas, all sorts of things, which would have provided a much stronger platform of understanding with which to engage very, very difficult issues. I think people have a right to be angry about things, but they also need to have that anger contextualized. They need to know what they're being angry about, not just a blank sheet of paper. And I think that we in our generation and the government of the day and civil society and others, having gone through that commission process, thought that they could just move on. I'll leave you with one thought. It was There's a very famous French philosopher called Jacques Derrida who came to South Africa in the early 2000s, and in fact it was a Saha conference in which he spoke at before he died, and he said that the Truth Commission was an exercise in forgetting, which shocked a lot of people. And they said, why? Well, so you went through the process, you gathered all this information, then you packed it up in boxes and you put it away and you didn't engage with it. So, and I think that we are really reaping the consequences of that approach here. So I think it's good that young people are questioning these things. I think it's good that the older generation are faced with difficult questions. But I'm very much hoping that there is going to be a process of interaction, dialogue and conversation, so people can understand why certain decisions were made, not always the right decisions, but there can be a constructive engagement on this, which will help a broader understanding of where we came from. Because, you know, a number of decisions were made in the early and the mid-1990s which were located in compromise. Mm. And I think people tend to forget this was a compromised outcome. You know, these were decisions that were made on the basis of a negotiated outcome. There was not a victor in this process. And I think a lot of younger generation actually assumed that somebody won. Well, yes, they won in that apartheid was ended, but they didn't win in terms of a military defeat in which the liberation movements could dictate the terms of the settlement. And the settlement was essentially agreed upon around this context of a constitution and a set of rules by which we would live. Now, part of that accepted that we had to deal with the past. I would say that we failed to deal with it effectively, and we failed to actually utilize those mechanisms effectively in a way which could have constructively informed the next generation.
That is so true. Thank you for coming. I will definitely try and get you in for a part two, because I think we've just barely scratched the surface. I think one of the biggest issues that we have in this generation is that we don't have these conversations enough. We are a 260 character generation, and that's pretty much it. So we get that information and the rage grows. And like you're saying, we don't even know what we're angry about, but there's a real sense of anger and feeling like something was stolen from us. And there's a need to understand how the decisions taken were taken so that we can be empowered to know that there is still work to be done and how we're going to take the project liberation forward.
And the younger generation are the central drivers of that, and should be, because they need to pick up the cudgels on this issue and drive them forward in terms of shining a light on the past, in terms of what happened, where those culpabilities lie, and how that relates and is relevant to the current struggles that we face in terms of contemporary struggles for justice.
Yeah. So thank you so much for coming to join us, Piers. We appreciate you. We will see you when you come back for part two.
Absolutely, Nobu. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed that. For more information, please visit our website on www.saha.org.za. Alternatively, you can go to www.foip.org.za.